That is one big pile of shit. This could be it. We may be in some multiverse where I don't even exist.
Don't knock rationalization. Where would we be without it?
Yes, yes. Yes, without the use.
To take them out, take them down. Do your stuff. Life finds a way.
Hello and welcome to episode 24 of The Complete Works, a deep dive into the career and films of actor Jeff Goldblum. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me on this journey into the wondrous world of Goldblum is my friend, co-host, and fellow Goldblumaniac,
Mike Tricio.
How you doing today, Mike?
I'm doing very good. I got my wires crossed a little bit in terms of my expectations for the intro bit, even though on Complete Works, it's the same thing every time. I was really nervous about what kind of weird fucking introduce me as bit you were going to pull, but that's for Mike and Mike. I forgot. What am I doing?
Yeah, no, Mike and Mike is where we let loose and just do whatever. This is a very professional podcast, Mike.
Oh, yes, of course. How could I forget?
The same intro every time. But this episode in particular, it feels like this is one we've been building up to for a little while now. I think, A, because it's such a major movie in the Jeff Goldblum canon, but also because just looking back on some of the previous movies we've talked about, it's almost like, hey, this is kind of like a stepping stone towards the movie we're talking about today. So back in 78, Jeff Goldblum appeared in an all-time great horror remake in a supporting role with Invasion of the Body Snatchers. In 85, Goldblum had his first leading role in Into the Night, or his first leading role in a theatrical release film, I should say. Right. With Into the Night. And that's a movie which featured cameos from a lot of contemporary directors at the time, including one David Cronenberg. And then a few months later, Goldblum appeared with Gina Davis for the first time in Transylvania 65,000, a movie that was directed by Rudy DeLuca, a frequent collaborator of Mel Brooks. And do you know why I bring up Mel Brooks, Mike?
Did he secret produce The Fly? I don't know. Yeah.
Yes, he did.
Did he really?
Yeah, if you watch the movie, the first thing you see is the Brooks Films logo. It's
I saw that and was like, huh, and didn't realize that was actually Mel Brooks. Incredible.
Yep. Yeah, no, it's very similar to The Elephant Man, which Mel Brooks also produced, the David Lynch movie. He produced this movie. You already revealed the title of it, which, oops.
It's in the title of the episode. They know.
That's true. He produced The Fly, but, you know, and it still says Brooks Films, but he took his name off of the movie as a producer, because he didn't want people to go see The Fly thinking that it was a Mel Brooks movie.
Wow.
which is a very noble thing of him to do, I think, because as soon as you go in there expecting a Mel Brooks movie, I feel like it's a very different kind of crowd that starts watching The Fly than would normally be doing that, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, like you said, he did that with Elephant Man, where he took his name out of it.
Right, exactly. So in the mid-80s, 20th Century Fox began the process of doing a new remake of the classic 1958 sci-fi horror film The Fly, which featured Vincent Price. And when the first draft of the script came through by Charles Edward Pogue, the studio was skeptical, but they agreed to distribute the movie if somebody else actually produced it. And that's when producer Stuart Kornfield brought on Mel Brooks, who was his friend. He produced the movie under Brooks Films, and though he liked the script, he felt a new writer was needed, and his first choice was David Cronenberg, a Canadian horror filmmaker who had broken out in America with movies like Scanners, Videodrome, and The Dead Zone at the time. Thing is, Cronenberg wasn't available. He was actually busy at the time working on an adaptation of Philip K. Dick's We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, a.k.a. the movie that would eventually become Total Recall, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Wow. Holy shit.
And directed by Paul Verhoeven. So Brooks moved on to his next choice because Cronenberg was busy, which was a young British director named Robert Bierman, who was scheduled to make the movie. He was about to fly out for pre-production, but had to drop out after a personal tragedy. Listeners to our old podcast might remember Bierman's name as the guy who eventually directed one of the all-time batshit insane Nicolas Cage performances of Vampire's Kiss.
Fuck yes.
Which, you know, based on Vampire's Kiss, that would have made The Fly a very different movie. Imagine if The Fly starred Nicolas Cage in the lead role.
Wow. Now, we're really crossing the timelines here. That would be out of control, especially how old was Cage in 1986?
This was the Boy in Blue era Nicolas Cage, if that helps you.
Amazing.
Yeah, that would have been insane. So Bierman left the project, and then David Cronenberg had also happened to leave Total Recall around the same time, which freed him up to come back to make the arguably defining film of his career and one of Jeff Goldblum's all-time greatest performances. It's 1986's The Fly.
I think you're making a mistake. I think you really want to talk to me.
Sorry, I have three other interviews to do before this party's over.
Yeah, but they're not working on something that'll change the world as we know it.
They say they are.
Yeah, but they're lying.
There is a limit, even to the imagination.
Human teleportation, molecular decimation, breakdown, and reformation is inherently purging.
Where our greatest creations meet our deepest fears.
Something went wrong, Seth. When you went through, something went wrong.
You are about to go beyond that limit.
Those weird hairs that were growing out of your back, I had them analyzed. But they were definitely not human.
If you saw how scared and angry and desperate he is...
I'm sure Typhoid Mary was a very nice person, too, when you saw her socially.
No!
You're afraid to be destroyed and recreated, aren't you?
You're changing, Seth. Everything about you is changing.
Oh, no. What's happening to me? Am I dying?
I want to know what's going on.
What does the disease want?
It wants to turn me into something else.
Oh, no.
A fly got into the transmitter pod with me that first time when I was alone.
Don't go back to it.
Could be contagious.
I'm afraid!
Don't be afraid!
No. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Help me.
Please. Help me. Now, Cronenberg had been making low-budget thrillers in Canada all throughout the 70s, like Shivers, Rabid, and The Brood. And even when he started to achieve more success in America, he stayed true to his Canadian roots, often working with the same people on his movies, using some of the same actors. We kind of talked about the kind of period in Canadian film history a while back when we were talking about Thresholds, that kind of period where there was a lot of like genre movies and sci-fi movies and horror movies that were made in a really low budget, often had kind of the same actors, the same crew while working on them.
Yeah, gotta love a Canadian tax shelter movie, you know?
Yes. Speaking of, I watched My Bloody Valentine, the original, this weekend.
Ooh.
Good shit. A plus. A lot of fun. Nice. And arguably the most Canadian of all those movies that I've seen. It's literally like... I mean, I'll talk about it a little bit in our discussions for my go to the movies, but like every actor has the most Canadian accent I've ever heard in a movie. It's incredible.
Perfect.
So David Cronenberg rewrote Charles Edward Pogue's original draft, though he still insisted Pogue get screen credit as it served as the kind of foundation for his script. And he assembled his team, his usual guys, and he got to work, deciding to cast Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis as the leads. So for his various transformations into Brundlefly, Goldblum would often spend up to 5 hours in the makeup chair a day. Extensive creature effects that were designed by Chris Wallace, who had just recently designed the creatures for Gremlins. Makeup work on this movie was so extraordinary, so revolutionary at the time, that even the Academy recognized it. The Oscars, not exactly known for recognizing horror movies all that often. rarely, if ever, I believe is the... about right. But The Fly won the Best Makeup Award that year, which was the only Oscar that it was nominated for. It was, however, recognized at the Saturn Awards, where it was nominated for 5 and won 3 Best Makeup, Best Actor for Jeff Goldblum, and Best Horror Film. So Jeff Goldblum stars in the lead role as Seth Brundle, a scientist working on teleportation pods that tries to do it himself, but doesn't notice a fly was in the pod with him. I hate when that happens.
Son of a bitch.
Something we can all relate to, I think. Now, Gina Davis plays Veronica Quaife, a journalist who falls in love with Brundle and tries to document his experiments. Now, this is their second movie together after she appeared in Transylvania 6 5000, and they began dating right around this time, too. They got married a year later in 1987. Although I think it's interesting, I don't think they share a scene in Transylvania 6 5000. They're both in the movie, and maybe they're like kind of in the same scene, you know what I mean? Like there's bits where they're like, they're both in the same carriage at the end, I think. But otherwise, like, I don't think they speak to each other at all in that movie.
No, I don't think they share any like dialogue, but they're definitely, like you said, in the carriage together at the end.
Yeah, like it was weird. When I saw that Gina Davis was in the movie, because I hadn't seen it before we watched it last week, I assumed that her character had a romance with Jeff Goldblum, just because in the other two movies they starred in, they have a romance together with The Fly and Earth Girls Are Easy. But no, Transylvania 6 5000, she has a romance with Ed Begley Jr., the natural alternative to to Jeff Goldblum.
You can say no.
So from there, you've got John Getz as Stathis Borans, Veronica's boss and ex-boyfriend. Getz is probably best known as the lead character of the Coen brothers' debut film Blood Simple, which fucking rules. Have you seen Blood Simple, Mike?
No.
Oh, man.
I haven't. Or it's one of those ones I've seen, like, on TNT or whatever. Like, I've never seen, like, the actual full version of it. So okay. I count that as no, which was the same as The Fly, to preempt your question coming up soon.
Really? Oh, yes. Man, that's interesting. All right. So John Getz also appeared in a few David Fincher movies, too. He was in Zodiac and The Social Network. He was one of the lawyers in that movie. From there, that's pretty much all the major characters in the movie, actually, which is kind of a nice change of pace from the huge ensembles of like 50 names I've had to read for the last few weeks, between Into the Night, Silverado, Transylvania 6 5000. There are a couple of smaller roles here and there. There's Tawny, a woman that Goldblum picks up at a bar. She's played by Joy Bouchel, who also appeared in Look Who's Talking. Marky is a guy that Goldblum arm wrestles with at the same bar. And he's played by George Chuvalo, a Canadian boxer who fought Muhammad Ali twice. Dr. Brent Cheevers is the doctor Veronica goes to for an abortion. He's played by Leslie Carlson, who has appeared in a few Cronenberg movies over the years. He was in Videodrome and The Dead Zone. He's also the guy in A Christmas Story who sells the family a Christmas tree. So there's that too. And finally, David Cronenberg himself has a cameo as a gynecologist during the dream sequence where Veronica imagines her baby coming out as a terrifying larva sac. Which is just a great sentence to say. And Cronenberg. Of course, Cronenberg is credited as co-writer along with Charles Edward Pogue, who also wrote movies like Psycho 3 and Dragonheart. And Cronenberg directed it 3 years after his previous film, The Dead Zone, 2 years before his next one, Dead Ringers, with Jeremy Irons. So The Fly was a huge hit when it came out on August 15th, 1986. Coincidentally, the same weekend that we're watching it this week. So happy 34th birthday, The Fly.
Yeah. Look at that. Synchronicity.
Yeah, there we go. So on a budget of roughly $15 million, it made about $60 million at the box office and opened at number one that weekend. If you weren't seeing it, you might have been seeing the John Candy movie Armed and Dangerous, or you could have been seeing Michael Mann's Manhunter, the original Hannibal Lecter movie featuring Brian Cox as Hannibal, which if you've never seen Manhunter, that movie fucking rules also. You should watch it.
Nice.
Also in the box office that week, Aliens, The Karate Kid Part 2, and Top Gun in its 14th week of release. And the IMDb plot synopsis for The Fly reads, a brilliant but eccentric scientist begins to transform into a giant man-fly hybrid after one of his experiments goes horribly wrong. So, Mike, you are saying, you said this a few minutes ago, you had only ever seen The Fly in bits and pieces on cable, it sounds like.
Yeah, I had never actually seen, like, the full theatrical version of it before, like, unedited and all that stuff. Which, you know, for all intents and purposes, especially for a movie like this, does not count as having seen it. So, yeah, I had basically never seen The Fly before.
Okay, interesting.
And here we are, man. I mean, this is what I was looking forward to. I know this is, like, you know, kind of a catapult for Goldblum into the greater pop culture consciousness.
Sure.
Like you said, he's been in a lot of supporting roles and stuff like that. And, you know, a pillar of the Cronenberg canon and horror canon and this is a very important movie. So I'm very excited that I finally got to watch it. I'm going to steal your quote, Mike, when you texted me and just said, The Fly, what a picture. Cause goddamn. Yeah, you're right. 100%. What a fucking movie this is. It's incredibly romantic and disgusting and horror, and it's peak, like, hot, sexy Goldblum. It's peak hot, sexy Gina Davis. It's peak hot, sexy Cronenberg, I guess, Cronenberg style.
I think Cronenberg would describe his movies as hot and sexy. I think
hot and sexy. Yeah. I mean, I haven't seen Crash, but from what you know, which is a movie about fucking car accidents, in case anyone doesn't know, as far as I've been told.
Yep.
Um, Yeah, I just saw actually somebody one of those Blu-ray companies put a like postcard in one of their new releases teasing that they're going to be doing Crash soon. I think it might have been Arrow.
Interesting.
I forget, though. So that's exciting. But anyway, The Fly, man, this movie rocks. I'm so glad I finally got to see it and cross this off the list.
Nice. Yeah, I had seen The Fly before a couple of times, actually. The first time was freshman year of college. I watched it just like on my own in my dorm room and loved it. I was a big fan of it immediately. And then I hadn't seen it for years until January of this year. The Roxy Theater, which is the indie theater near my house in Missoula, Montana, they were doing a 35 millimeter David Cronenberg double feature of The Fly and Videodrome. So, of course, I went, you know, it was obviously I can't not go to that. So I went and at that point, we knew we were doing Jeff Goldblum. Like, we knew Jeff Goldblum was in the card. So I knew I was going to have to rewatch the movie at some point. But that was before the pandemic really kicked into gear. And we were still planning on doing an episode every 2 weeks instead of an episode a week. So I was like, well, it'll probably be like a full year before I get to watch The Fly again. So I might as well watch it now. And by the time we get to it, I'll have forgotten stuff and everything. And instead, things happened the way they happened. And so a few months later, I'm watching The Fly. Which also, I mean, in a couple of weeks, Centerfield Cinema, which I've talked about on the other podcast, cool thing that the Roxy is doing with the local baseball stadium where they're doing socially distanced outdoor movies. They're showing Jurassic Park in a couple of weeks. And of course, I'm going, and then I'm going to have to rewatch Jurassic Park again a few months later.
Yeah, but yeah, who doesn't rewatch Jurassic Park every 6 months anyway?
That's also true. I have like stopped on Jurassic Park a few times on cable this year and just watched it for like an hour. So, you know, it's the best. But yeah, The Fly. So I had seen it once in freshman year of college and then twice this year. And yeah, the movie fucking rules. It's the best. It's incredible. I think Goldblum and Gina Davis are just immediately outstanding together. The effects work is some of the best ever put to film. And the movie just moves. Like, I think what struck me this time, and I think it's because I've mentioned also in the other podcast, I've been listening to a lot of Blank Check over the last year, which is a podcast about directors' filmographies, kind of like this podcast, except for directors. And we started around the same time, but we had the concept first. So just throwing that out there.
Yeah, we win.
But there was an episode recently that I listened to, and I'm still kind of catching up on the whole thing. So this is from like a year ago. But Alex Ross Perry was the guest star. Alex Ross Perry, who's the director of Her Smell. And he kind of talked about his opinion that like most movies start too early. You know, you have like 30 minutes of setup and then you get to the actual movie. And so watching The Fly, I was like, man, this movie just starts. this does not have that problem because it literally, there's no setup for the characters. It starts up like mid conversation between Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis having already met. You don't even get a scene where they introduce themselves because that's not relevant. Wow. And you could pick it up in context, you know? So they're just like mid conversation having met for the first time. And then you just keep going from there. And then it ends abruptly too. As soon as spoiler alert, Goldblum dies, movie's over. Like there's not even like a scene where she kind of like breaks down crying. And then like, there's no like, oh, well, at least he was the greatest fly there ever lived or something like that. No, he's just dead and the movie's over.
Yeah. We don't deal with the guy dying on the floor. We don't deal with the body of the Brundle fly. We don't deal with anything. Fade to black, roll credits. Like, hell yeah. This movie is like a tight 93 minutes or something like that.
Yep.
And just perfect. Chef's kiss.
Yeah. And it's so sparse, too. It only has three main characters, really, between Goldblum, Veronica, and Stathis, whatever his name is. John Getz's character.
The other guy.
You know, they're really only the three main characters in the movie. Most of it takes place in an empty warehouse. It just feels like, you know, they put all of the budget into getting Goldblum and Gina Davis and the rest of it into all the creature effects that went to the movie. And it shows like everything the movie's going. It's the goopiest movie ever made. I think it's very gooey, very disgusting. And it's awesome. Loved every second of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just so funny to be like, this movie is absolutely disgusting. And I love it.
Give me more.
And I think they even are sequels.
Yes. Yeah. Well, this was a remake, obviously, as we talked about before, of the movie from the 50s with Vincent Price, which I've never seen. I was hoping to actually watch that before this podcast just for like extra context, but I didn't get the time. But I know there's two sequels to that movie. There's like The Curse of the Fly and like Revenge of the Fly or something like that.
The Fly 3D.
Yeah, exactly. And then there was this movie, the remake in the 80s. And then there was a one sequel to this movie called The Fly 2, Which the only returning actor to that movie is John Getz, actually, apparently.
Never saw that coming.
Yeah, well, obviously Goldblum's not in it. There is archive footage of Goldblum from the first movie. And I think the opening scene of the movie is a Gina Davis's, because I was reading Into the Fly 2, obviously, for research for this podcast. Mm-hmm. And the opening scene of the movie is Gina Davis's character giving birth to the baby that she was having in this movie. Wow. And it is, in fact, a larvae sac, like in the dream sequence.
Incredible.
And she dies like during childbirth, like she immediately dies from shock. But then when the larvae sac hatches, it's like a normal human kid. It's not like a weird fly monster. But then I think the plot of the movie is like the kid like develops fly abilities over time and stuff and all the crazy stuff. After that, I didn't want to read any more spoilers because like it's upsetting that they killed off Gina Davis' character in the first 5 minutes. Yeah. But I do kind of want to see the movie. It's also directed by the guy who did the special effects for this movie. So there you go.
There's some potential there.
There definitely is. But other elements I wanted to kind of quickly highlight is that Howard Shore's score for the movie is so good and immediately just like gets you into it. And he has worked with Cronenberg 17 times over the course of Cronenberg's career. He is the John Williams to Cronenberg Spielberg. And he's really incredible in this. There's also just a great, like, dry sense of humor in all the dialogue, which I really love. Like, there's a lot of, like, just fun, like, one-liners and quips and stuff. And Cronenberg loves grossing people out with Brundlefly, and, like, the various stages of Goldblum's transformation is just really well executed. It's so well done.
Yeah. I was really shocked at how, like, sometimes laugh out loud funny this movie is.
Yeah.
Like, amidst the horror, you know, where Goldblum's just like, oh, that was disgusting. Sorry. Like that's fucking hilarious.
Yep.
I was very shocked at that. And like you kind of said already, like this movie just like is, has such a great pace to it where like, it never feels like, okay, now we have to stop and explain or what, like there's no minute that it wasn't like, give me more, you know?
Right. So of course, Jeff Goldblum is the star of the movie as Seth Brundle / Brundlefly. What did you think of Jeff Goldblum in The Fly, Mike?
I mean, this is the actual natural evolution of the performances of Goldblum we've seen so far. I forget what my canned answer was for it was something like that for Cage. But yeah, I mean, he's amazing. He's great. He's full fledged leading man, and like you said, he's kind of been leading up to this throughout the other movies we've covered so far. And he's, you know, he's just so handsome and sweaty, and which is nice for the first half, and then it's not sweat anymore and it's just goop, and it's bad for the second half. But but yeah, he's so charismatic and charming and fun, and then also like very menacing at like, you know, the halfway part where he like has been transformed in some way but we're not sure yet, and he like is just like stalking through the streets of what, LA or wherever this is, I don't even know, and like looking for trouble. And it's like, it's actually scary. Like you, like, you know, you kind of forget that Goldblum is like, you know, 6'5" or 4" or whatever, however tall he is. Right. He's like a pretty menacing, can be a menacing figure. And like, damn, son.
Yeah. Which is why, of course, he was cast for all those menacing hoods and hoodlums in Death Wish and Special Delivery and St. Ives and all those movies.
Shit, man, got business, you know?
Exactly. I think this is arguably, and I say arguably because we haven't watched all the movies yet, I think this is arguably Jeff Goldblum's best performance. Like, just he is incredible in this movie. And there are so many layers to what he's doing here because he has so many different personalities to play. And he plays it, almost all of them feel like a different side of Jeff Goldblum that you see in other movies. But he's like tosses them all into one movie here. He opens up in the movie. He's like kind of the neurotic, nervous, sort of shy guy. He's just excited about his work. He wants to share it. And then he's the romantic guy with Gina Davis. And then he's the confident guy who's finally secure in his own body. And that's, it felt like it was Ian Malcolm from Jurassic Park, just like a few years early during that stage, which was kind of cool. And then he's like the panicky guy once he realizes what's happening. And then he kind of becomes the villain of the movie as he sort of accepts what's happened to him. And he starts developing this kind of maniacal plan. And he's a tragic figure, and he has to do a lot of work through a lot of layers of makeup for a lot of this movie too, and he nails it. I mean, he's incredible.
I'd put out 5 hours of makeup on, and I was sort of naked essentially, except I've got, you know, foam rubber glued all over me, and they built this wall, this brick wall kind of at about this angle, very steep, 4 stories high, and I climbed all the way to the top of it, and the makeup man greased me up all over with KY jelly. At the end of the day, they said they'd used 55 tubes of KY jelly. And on action, I jump backwards on my hands and knees on the wall and slide very fast down the 4 stories, and at the bottom, slam myself into this wall of metal. And they say, cut, and they sort of, the crew's going to clap, and they say, okay, that was fine, Jeff, okay, well, you do it again. And I did it all day long. There were, like, times on this movie where I said to myself, you're a good sport. I guess you'll do anything.
Yeah, I was very surprised. Well, I mean, like, it's incredible on one level that, like, it is Goldblum the whole movie. Like, it could have not been him under the makeup, you know,
That's true.
Like, I mean, it is. Like, but there is a version where, like, the leading actor is like, I'm not going to do that kind of thing.
Right.
But, yeah, he's amazing. And I think it really helps when he is, like, full Brundlefly, I guess. Well, not full Brundlefly, but, you know, three quarters of Brundlefly.
Right.
That, like, you can still tell, like, he has all the, like, mannerisms and tics of Goldblum. And I absolutely is worth it.
Yeah, he pretty much has that up until the point where he sheds the Goldblum skin and just becomes a full-on fly, at which point I don't think it's Goldblum anymore.
No.
It's probably, like, an animatronic or something, but, like, yeah.
Yes.
But that's great. Plus, I mean, his relationship with Geena Davis, which is like the heart of this movie, it feels so genuine. And that's probably partially because they were actually dating like at the time or like around that time where they were developing a romance. Or I'm not sure the exact timeline was like as the movie was being filmed and stuff, but like it feels very genuine. There's a genuine connection there. And Geena Davis, I mean, I talked about this a little bit in our Transylvania 65,000 episode. She's the best. She's one of my favorite actresses who kind of like just fell off the face of the earth after like 96. Like she's been in stuff here and there, but like she used to be like top lining movies for a good like 8 year stretch where she had, you know, The Fly and then Beetlejuice and League of Their Own and The Long Kiss Goodnight and Thelma and Louise and like just these incredible movies. And she's great in all of them. And it's just a bummer that like she's not still in, like, I can't believe the Marvel Cinematic Universe hasn't snapped her up for something, you know, like the way they did Jeff Goldblum. Like that would be the ultimate move if like Taika Waititi brings her into Thor 4 and like has her and Jeff Goldblum share a scene together. I think that'd be great.
Unless it's some weird Game of Thrones thing where they can't share a scene together in their contracts or some shit.
It's possible because who knows what, like how bad their divorce was or whatever in 1990. I have no idea. Who knows what their personal lives are like, but she's great. She's great in this movie. She's so good. And I think her relationship with Goldblum in this movie specifically, like, it's just like you don't spend a lot of time with them either before they hook up. But like you're completely invested in their relationship as soon as it happens. You're like, yeah, that makes sense. And they are terrific together. And let's go with this. And then it's like another 10 minutes with that relationship. And then he turns into the fly and he becomes an asshole. You know, this movie moves very quick.
Yeah. And I love that about it. And yeah, but I agree 100%. Geena Davis is outstanding in this movie. And they like are equals, I think, in this movie, like in terms of their performances. Like it is, I guess, a Goldblum movie, quote unquote, especially through like the context we're talking about it in. But it is also definitely like a Geena Davis movie.
Totally. All right. So as far as Jeff Goldblum goes, how do you think this role, The Fly, fits into the roles that we've seen so far, Mike?
Well, I think, you know, Body Snatchers is the obvious touch point comparison to make, you know, a remake of a classic 1950s sci-fi movie. There's medical stuff like Threshold, which is weird. I forget what other movie. Buckaroo Banzai, I think, actually, we talked about as having like a surgery scene. We're like, oh, it counts for Threshold. But also, I think Buckaroo Banzai is another touch point, particularly the scene we highlighted in that episode with the like Orson Welles like War of the Worlds conspiracy thing that he like discovers or figures out in Buckaroo Banzai. But like that moment is like the big Goldblum moment where he has like this kind of long monologue where he's explaining stuff. And that's kind of like his whole character in The Fly. He just has this long technical scientific monologue. And I just kept thinking of Buckaroo Banzai. So that's fun. I guess we'll go back to the evergreen Next Stop Greenwich Village audition scene here, where it feels like we're finally getting the guy that, you know, studied the method or whatever the hell. I forget when he lists all his credentials, like in Next Stop Greenwich Village. It feels like you said, we're kind of getting the full view of that as a leading man. That actor's made it. That guy did it, you know?
Definitely, yeah. I also had Threshold down because, you know, it's Goldblum, again, playing a scientist on the verge of something big, right? Like in Threshold, where he was the inventor of the artificial heart. This time he's like about to invent teleportation. It's very exciting. Body Snatchers, obviously. Also, when he becomes confident Goldblum, like after he's been transformed, but before he becomes, you know, transforms that like maybe 10 minute period where he's like confident Goldblum and he's like just rattling things off and he goes to a bar and picks up a woman. He sort of becomes like a more menacing version of his character and like Thank God It's Friday or Between the Lines, like that kind of like lady killer character who's very smooth and like very talkative and stuff, but like there's an added menace to it this time around.
That tracks. I didn't think of those, that where it's kind of those smaller, like, throwaway. Well, not in between the lines. He is a pretty significant character, but it definitely, thank God it's Friday.
Right.
But yeah, that makes sense with the, like, kind of, it's not so much like sleazy like it is in between in Thank God It's Friday. And in this one, it's like kind of just outright scary the way he is acting in that bar particularly.
Right. But yeah, so there you go. All right. So what are the moments or scenes in The Fly that stood out to you, Mike?
Well, if we just say anything with Brundlefly, and just we'll save that for later, I'm sure. But like this one's like a kind of cheeky answer, but like the obvious gymnast that replaces him in those like trapeze shots is just hilarious. And I love it. It's so silly. It really like shines in the like brings in that like low budget 80s feel that this movie does not have at all. Except for those two scenes where it's like very clearly not Goldblum.
That's fair. That's fair. Yeah. So you're talking about the scene where it's like right after it's like the day after he went through the teleporter and the Fly fused with him. And he wakes up the next day and he's like exercising and he's like doing like handstand pushups on a chair. And like he's like doing these like spinny thing around like on the pipe stuff. And Gina Davis is watching it. And like every woman in the audience watching is like, wow, Jeff Goldblum.
It turns out he glistens.
Yeah.
He's doing the Spider-Man discovering he has powers thing, basically.
Right. Although it went a lot better for Spider-Man, I feel like. In the grand scheme of things.
In the long run. There is certainly a Cronenberg version of Spider-Man that is the same as this movie, just the spider. But in the comic books, it works out pretty okay, you know?
I do have like a... When they were doing the Spider-Verse comic book event, they did like these one-off comics of like alternate universe Spider-Man and stuff. And usually they were like to build up Spider-Man, like these different Spider-Mans before they were about to show up to the event or that kind of thing. Like there would be a Spider-Man noir, like one-off comic. And that's where they introduced Spider-Gwen and stuff. And one of them was just like this horror story about a Peter Parker that was bit by a spider and turned into like this giant spider and started eating Uncle Ben and Aunt May.
Oh, my God. That's incredible.
So that does exist in the Marvel Universe, is what I'm saying, Mike. That is canon in a weird...
Isn't Spider-Ham a spider bit by a radioactive pig or some stupid shit like that? Yeah, okay.
You are correct.
Welcome to Spider-Cast.
Yes, this is now a Spider-Man podcast. You're welcome, America. There's not enough talk of comic book superheroes these days, Mike. I feel like we need to really break ground on this.
Yeah, we need two more white guys to talk about comic books.
Yes, exactly. So we start at a science conference mid-conversation between Goldblum and Davis. He invites her back to his apartment to show her what he's been working on. I think what I like about this, just the way the dialogue is written and stuff, like it does a lot of the exposition for you, but it feels like it's just part of the conversation. Like as they're driving back, Goldblum has motion sickness in the car and he's saying, oh, I hate vehicles and things like that. Like it gives you a motivation for why he would want to create teleportation without having him to be like, you know, well, I get sick from like having him explain that to Gina Davis later on, you know?
Yeah, it does this really fine line thing between him like not being the like mad scientist, like he's not the Dr. Mavalakwa or whatever the hell from Transylvania 65,000.
Right.
He's just a guy that gets motion sickness and he's like, I just want to teleport. I'm sick of this shit, which I think is really interesting. Like there's not a hint of malevolence in his intentions before he gets fused with the Fly, which I think is really interesting.
It kind of plays like that for a bit where it's just like he's acting sort of creepy, right? He sits down on the piano and he plays a little bit and she's like,
right.
And she's like, well, now that you've seen it, I can't let you leave here alive. Ha 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 ha. And like all this stuff. But it's less of like genuine menace as more of like, this is a guy who has not interacted with people in a long time. And he's just like, and he's like genuinely just excited to show off his work because he's never shown it to anybody before. And that kind of thing. So he shows her the teleporters and they kind of they test it out on her stocking. And she's like confused and she doesn't really know what it is. But then he finally explains it and it's the actual thing. So she kind of starts recording the story because this is like a huge scientific breakthrough. But then Goldblum realizes that she's recording it and he's like, oh, I don't want you to record this. And she's like, I'm a journalist. You knew that. And I was like, yeah, I know.
Now that you're doing journalism, we can't have that.
But instead, he's just like, he just genuinely wanted to show his work off and that kind of thing. So she leaves with the recording. But she plays the tape for Stathis, her boss, who you later find out is her ex-boyfriend, who and he immediately thinks it's a hoax. Like, he's like, this guy's insane. He's a magician, whatever.
He's doing the so prestige with the two boxes. He's doing the prestige. That's what he says.
Oh, yes. Yes. That is exactly
not literally.
Right. But. So Stathis is like, this guy's a crazy person. But then Goldblum shows up. And this is where, like, the romance between him and Geeta Davis really kicks off. Is just like, after the scene, he's like, all right, I'm going to stop you with one magic word. Cheeseburger. and
it would, they it go, would work on me.
Yeah, exactly. If Goldblum just came up to you and said the word cheeseburger, you would immediately melt. That's all it would take. But she and Goldblum go on this, lunch date, get a cheeseburger. And he kind of convinces her, you know, hey, I don't want anybody to find out about this yet. It's not done yet. Because right now I can only teleport objects. I can't teleport people. And he has plans to ultimately teleport himself, but he wants her to be the one to like document it. And so that's basically like, that's everything about the relationship you need to know. And then when she gets home, Stathis in the shower when she gets home. And that's when you kind of discover he was her ex-boyfriend. And which again, another really just easy way of like, cause that first scene they have together when she's showing him the recording, there's no like indication that like they dated or anything like that. He's just like, well, this guy's crazy. And then he leaves. But like at that point, he's like in the shower and she's like, what the fuck are you doing here? And she flushes the toilet on him and he like, it's pretty funny. And it's just like a very quick, like economical way of getting it out there. Like, oh, they used to date. They don't anymore. All right, we're done. That's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very strange at first. Cause like, I couldn't really tell it was the same guy. But they were like kind of talking about like the editor stuff. And I was like, what is why does everyone know what's going on? And then like, you know, a few minutes later, I was like, oh, it's the same guy. Okay. But I thought that was really a really convenient and easy way to be like, and she, you know, and she's like, oh, I should have changed the locks. And that tells you everything you need to know about their relationship. And you have that kind of like weird, boss employee scuzziness going on. And there is some of that, I think, where she's keeps trying to rebuff him throughout the movie. And he's like, well, come on, baby. not quite, but basically,
that was a great impression, by the way. That was really good.
That was it. Nailed it. Direct line. Perfect. You wouldn't even tell. Yep. It was not me. Yep.
You kind of establish that stuff. And then at that point, it's them trying to test out the teleporter. Goldblum tries to teleport a monkey, and that does not go as planned. The
monkey turns inside out.
Yeah, the monkey turns inside out, and that's like the first like gross effect you see in the movie, I think, right? It's pretty much it. When they open the teleporter, and I mean, first off, the monkey, like, his hand like hits the door of the teleporter and the blood kind of falls down the window. And it's like, ooh, boy, that doesn't look good. And then they open the door and it's just like this like bubbling pile of like in organs.
Yeah.
Which is really great. And it made me wonder, like, why did he choose monkeys to start with? Like, maybe he should have chosen mice or something a little less, something that wouldn't cause that big of a mess, you know?
Well, it's interesting too, because like I think he already has, because Geeta Davis, when they're having the cheeseburgers, she asked him like, what happens if you teleport living tissue? And he says, well, not while we're eating. So like, I think he knows already what happened.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Exposition. You got to pay attention, Mike.
Yeah. You're right. My bad. But if that's the case, you would think maybe he would try doing it on smaller things and getting it right first before moving on.
I think it's very funny that like after that point, they're like, let's just try a raw steak. Like after they've already turned a baboon inside out. Baby steps, you know?
Exactly. So the monkey turns inside out and there's like a really good scene of like her, she's like videotaping the whole thing and she kind of has like, the people need to know what you're thinking. That's the, you know, the kind of found footage line of like, everybody deserves to know what's happening here. And Goldblum's like, fuck is what I'm thinking. And he's just like so frustrated and he's trying to get it. And then like the next scene, it's like Goldblum and her like just in the room together and they're trying to figure it out. And she notices that he always wears the exact same clothes. He has a big closet just full of the same suit. And that's when they hook up for the first time. And she's like, you're cute, you know that? And he's like, I am. I'm Jeff Goldblum.
I have a lot long hair right now.
Exactly. So they hook up, they have sex, and then Goldblum gets a microchip stuck in his back. Or whatever it is. I think it's a microchip. Which leaves like a scratch, like three lines in his back. Which happens to be positioned like the wing of a fly. Like when you see it, it just looks like that. Like, And that becomes pretty important later on. But that's like just a quick thing. It's like, oh, geez, I was wondering where I put that. And they tosses it away. But then Goldblum has that eureka moment. They teleport the steak and then he cooks it afterwards. And he has Gina Davis kind of test out the steak. And the teleported one tastes like weird and synthetic because he didn't account for the flesh. And he like figures that out. And so now, and because it's a Cronenberg movie, you have the word flesh appearing a lot. People are saying yeah. flesh over and over again. But also Gina Davis has one of my favorite lines in this scene, which is like, all right, now try this steak that came through the teleporter. And she's like, what are you fucking crazy? A monkey just came out of there. A monkey yeah. just came apart in there.
She gets it. Gina Davis is the only one that knows what's going on in this movie.
Exactly. So, they did the steak thing, which is good. And then they figure it out. They like teleport another monkey. And this time it works. And it's a big thing, like, oh man, they figured it out. They're popping the champagne. They're going to order Chinese food and all this stuff. And then before they can celebrate, Veronica has to leave and deal with Stathis, who's threatening to blow the whole story on the cover of their magazine before it's ready. So, I mean, up to this point, Mike, I mean, what'd you think of the whole the steak thing, the monkey thing, everything going on?
Yeah, it's great. There's this kind of like, I don't want to say like Shakespearean feel to this, but there's this kind of like grand tragic romance thing happening throughout this entire movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's like with capital letters where, you know, like you said, it's kind of just this breezy relationship that they fall into. And I think Goldblum even says, like, is this a romance we're having? And it's yes. like when they're pouring the champagne after the baboon survives. And like, it really kind of feels like that. Like, there's kind of just like this weird dialogue. Like, it's not like a mumblecore movie. Like, it doesn't feel naturalistic the way they're talking. It just really kind of all works. Like, there's this like weird spell this movie has that like it puts on me. And like, I'm in for the whole ride. You know,
definitely. Also, I would like to watch a whole movie of Jeff Goldblum getting drunk with a monkey because I think that would be great.
Show me the deleted scenes.
Yes. So Veronica leaves to deal with Stathis and, you know, kind of calm down the whole situation and, you know, kind of tell him like, hey, you have to stop. This is ridiculous, which he finally agrees to do, you know, after saying a couple more crude things. But then that's happening, Goldblum kind of puts it together like, you know, he's like, why did she leave so suddenly? And then he realizes like, oh, Stathis must be her ex-boyfriend and like blah blah blah, and he's like thinking like, oh, she's going to have sex with Stathis, and like he's just getting in his head and he's getting drunk with the monkey. And then while he's doing this, which by the way, at this point in time you see the monkey swatting a fly away, which, you know, that might come up in a bit. This movie is called The Fly.
So
Goldblum's drunk and he decides, you know what, fuck it, I'm just gonna go through it. The monkey seems fine. Like the plan was to go send the monkey away to a lab and get it tested for weeks or whatever, and then it would come back and like, it would make sure like everything's good. But Goldblum's like in a drunken haze and he's like, all right, fuck it, I'll do it myself. And so he goes in the teleporter. He's completely naked, does not notice the fly on the window of the teleporter. And then he goes through and then things happen.
Yeah, I mean, hijinks ensue. That scene is so tense. Like, I've never been more freaked out by a fly, I think, than in this movie. Like, because that scene, it spends so long. Like you say, the monkey's swatting the fly, and then he's punching in the thing, and the fly is like on the door on the outside, and he's getting in, and the door the door's starting to close, and the monkey's looking at the fly, and then it gets inside, and you're like, oh no! And then we're seeing the countdown, and then the fly's on the window. And it's like, holy shit, man, Cronenberg's a great director. Turns out.
Yeah, I think what also makes it so effective is the fly is such a small insect, right? It's such a small, I think most people would view it as a very insignificant, you know, thing. You know, it's something you wouldn't even think about. I mean, the monkey's swatting at it before, and that's like the most you ever think about a fly in your entire life, right? Like, if this movie had like a bigger animal that he fused with or something like that, like if this movie was like the Barracuda or something.
to pick a random animal.
Yeah, it wouldn't be scary, you know, because I mean, barracudas are bigger. You like, they're more noticeable. I think with the fly, it's an everyday thing. It's everyone sees flies almost every day, but you don't think about them that much. But like, it fucks up his entire day, you know,
and his life.
Say the least. Well, yes, that too. Actually, I mean, I wouldn't say it fucks up his entire day, because like the next day after it is pretty good. Like, it's a pretty good day.
That's true. After
the teleportation, pretty much immediately after that first day, it all goes downhill for Jeff Goldblum. But that first like day or so, it's solid. It's solid for him. So he goes through. The fly has now fused with his body, although he doesn't know that yet because he didn't see the fly. Veronica returns. He kind of tells her what happened. Like, I went through, And you notice that hairs start growing out of the cut that was on his back with the microchip that was left there. And that's the thing. Like, it almost makes the thing, like, if he didn't have like an open wound, maybe the fly wouldn't have fused with him. Maybe he just would have like gone through or something. Who's to say? Or he would have absorbed the fly, which is what he asks the machine later. Like, did Brundle absorb the fly? And the machine's like, no, you fused together.
Yeah.
Whoops.
I also love this like one particular era of like science fiction computer stuff in movies is where you're just like talking to a computer. Like, I just yes. love that. Like, you're having a conversation with like, what happened to fly? And the computer's like, and it gives you an answer. Like, that's hilarious. I love that idea where it's not like you have to do anything in your brain. Like, yep. you just have to literally ask the computer.
Right. Which, if this was filmed today, it would be like, Siri, what happened to fly? And then Siri would be like, here are 83 possible options.
That's true.
That I found around the internet about what happened to fly.
Maybe I was more off base in my criticism than I thought.
So Goldblum wakes up the next day and he immediately like just grabs the fly in his hand. Like, he sees like the fly is like buzzing around him and he kind of grabs it and then he like lets go and the fly flies away. And that's when he does the handstand push-ups. He starts spinning around the ceiling. They're at a coffee shop and he's putting like a ton of sugar in his coffee and all that stuff. And he's doing these like big monologues about like, oh, I feel amazing. This is incredible. He seems like he's on cocaine is basically what yeah. he's doing.
So I asked the computer if it had improved me and it said it didn't know what I was talking about. And that's made me think very carefully about what I've been feeling and why. And I'm beginning to think that the sheer process of being taken apart atom by atom and put back together again, why, it's like coffee being put through a filter. It's somehow a purifying process. It's purified me. It's cleansed me. And I'll tell you, I think it's going to allow me to realize the personal potential I've been neglecting all these years that I've been obsessively pursuing goal after goal.
Do you normally take coffee with your sugar?
What? You know, I just don't think I've ever given me a chance to be me. But, of course, interestingly, at the exact same moment that I achieved what will probably prove to be my life's work, that's the moment when I started being the real me, finally. So, listen, not to wax messianic, but it may be true that the synchronicity of those two events might blur the resultant individual effect of either individually. But it is nevertheless also certainly true, I will say now, however subjectively, that human teleportation, molecular decimation, breakdown, and reformation is inherently purging. It makes a man a king. From the moment I walked out of the pod, I felt like $1 million. You know, I think I am going to have a cannoli after all. Waiter, I mean, what an accomplishment. But what have I really done, though? All I've done is say to the world, let's go, move, catch me if you can. Waiter, Jesus Christ.
It's you know, the Goldblum persona times 10, I feel like. It's just like everything that you associate with Jeff Goldblum, just like faster. You know?
Yeah. I love that section where it's like he's not physically transforming yet, but like he just immediately is always eating junk food and sugar. Like, that's yes. like such a perfect detail for someone turning into a fly just being obsessed with sugar. Yep. It's amazing.
Yeah, and then he and Veronica, they have sex for hours when she notices the hair on right. his back, which is such a Cronenberg-y sequence too. It's I mean, you mentioned before there's a movie where Cronenberg has sex with car accidents, right? That's like it's kind of his thing. Like, it's all body horror, but it's also very sexual in his work, and it's mm-hmm. pretty wild. And this movie is the ultimate manifestation of that, I feel like, where it's like Goldblum transforming into this horrible thing, but he's also pretty hot for most of the movie until he becomes like the fly, you know, like until he starts like really transforming.
Yeah, I mean, even when he goes out to the bar and picks up that woman and stuff and he brings her home, and then I think it's pretty clear they've had sex, but he like looks awful, like, but even still yes. he's like this strapping, you know, virile man or whatever. It's very strange. What a weird, you know, what a classic Cronenberg juxtaposition.
Yeah, exactly. So so he wants Veronica to teleport because he feels amazing, and then he thinks like he's gained like powers because of the teleportation and they can be like a super couple or whatever yeah. it is. And so she refuses. She doesn't want to do it. She's scared of it. And she kind of sees what's happening to him, even though he doesn't see it yet. And so they get into a huge fight. He storms out. And that's when he goes to the bar, gets into an arm wrestling competition where he snaps a dude's wrist off. And not even just snaps a dude's wrist. I mean, snap the wrist off, like the bone yeah. like comes out of his skin. It's gnarly.
And then he grabs the woman and is like, let's go, babe. No, what did I say the editor says? Come on, baby.
Exactly. Yep, that's exactly what happens. Yeah. And so she goes home with him. They're going up the steps, and he has a pretty funny line where they're going up and she's like tired. Like, there's so many steps. He's like, don't you have an elevator or something? And he like picks her up, like, don't you feel elevated? And he like just carries her, carries her up the steps. So he brings her home and he goes through the teleporter again, and he wants her to do it. Like, he doesn't care at this point. He had such a genuine connection with Gina Davis at the start of the movie, and now he doesn't care who it is that goes through the teleporter that can be his like super couple partner. He just wants anybody to do it just so like somebody else can feel the power like surging through them or whatever. So he's like trying to force her to go through the teleporter. And that's when Veronica shows up with the classic, the killer line, the tagline of the movie, actually. You know, he's like, don't be afraid. And she's like, be afraid, be very afraid. which was the tagline of the movie and became like a pretty iconic tagline. Like, I never associated it with The Fly specifically, but that's just a line that's been in my head since I was a kid. Like, I've known that line forever.
I thought they were quoting something in this movie. Like, when that happened, I thought it was like a reference to something. Like, remember, what did we talk about that we was it Airplane or something recently? Maybe that was on Mike and Mike. When movies quote like stuff of their time that like you lose the context for. Like, I thought that's what was happening in The Fly. Like, when that happened, I was like, oh, that's fun. I wonder what that's from. turns out it's from this.
Yeah, no, that's from this movie, which is pretty cool. Plus, this also has one of my other favorite lines in the movie, which is, you know, it sets up before, like, they can't go back to Tawny's place because Tawny lives with her mother, so she has to go to Goldblum's. And then when Gina Davis shows up, Tawny's like, who is this? And Goldblum's like, oh, I forgot to tell you, I live with my mother too.
He's so gross in this part, though.
Oh, yeah, no, he's a complete piece of shit at this point. But I think what this movie does so well is it makes Goldblum seem as if he is like irredeemable. Then it like brings him back to the brink of sympathy once you see like the crazy transformation that he's going through. Yeah. And then it like brings him right back to irredeemable again and then back to sympathy. And like by the end, you're like, oh, what a tragic figure. What a tragic fly this fly was.
Yeah. Poor fly.
Yeah. Poor fly. Don't bother me. is that the song? Is that the line?
I think that's how it goes. Yeah.
He punches the wall. He kicks Veronica out. But that's like as soon as she leaves, that's when like his body starts deteriorating too. Like he's in the bathroom and he notices his fingernail like kind of askew and he like bites it and it comes off. And then he like squeezes his finger and pus squirts out and goes all over the mirror and it's like, yeah, bleh.
People, you know, you always talk about people like people's like limits with like gore things and stuff in horror movies. And it's like, you know, some people can't stand things with eyes or whatever. I think fingernails might be mine. Like I did not expect to have such a visceral reaction to that, which happens by accident. So like to the point where he doesn't really notice it at first. And then he looks down and he's like, oh shit, my fingernail's gone. And then he pulls a couple more off and like, nah, like why? Come on. Why have we got to do that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, can you believe that a movie this gross was like a huge box office hit in 1986? Like, this was number one at the box office, one of the biggest, most talked about movies of that year. Like, I can't picture like a major studio putting this movie out in 2020, you know? I don't see it
won
happening.
An Oscar, Mike.
I know.
That's won the crazy. Oscar.
It's crazy. So he starts analyzing the teleporting sequence and finally discovers that it fused his body with the fly's body. And then 4 weeks pass, like about a month passes, and he calls Veronica and she comes over. And this is the first time they've seen each other in 4 weeks. And he is just not in good shape at this point. to say the least, he's walking with two canes. His face is covered with stuff. With like mold and sweat and like all this like gross stuff, and his face like looks like different than it did. It's like rounder. You know, he's like trying to explain to Veronica what happened, how it fused him with the fly. And, you know, there's one point where he grabs a donut and like douses it in mouth acid so he can eat it. Like he just picks it up and just like a bunch of like white liquid falls out of his mouth. And it's like, oh, that was really gross, huh? And then rather than just end on that, his ear falls off too.
Just to really drive it home that he's not in good shape.
Exactly. So his ear falls off and she's terrified. And so she goes to Stathis and she's like, I don't know what to do. He's a fucking fly. And then she goes back and she like goes to get footage of him to show to Stathis. And when she goes back, he's not really in the same mindset that he was the first time. Cause the first time he's like, you know, pathetic and he's like making peace with the fact that he's dying. He thinks it's like some form of cancer. And then when she goes back the second time, he's like climbing on the ceiling and he's like, I'm becoming Brundlefly. Ha ha. And he's like doing these videos. They shoot a video and he's like almost like teaching it to children. Like, how does Brundlefly eat? And he like does the mouth thing and like for the food that's around him and stuff like that. And he's just like, he's like excited now to be like a part of this new evolutionary thing. Which is such a huge 180 from when you saw him 2 minutes ago.
Yeah, it's also this like really weird, a very human thing, I think, like this human impulse to like want a legacy, because that's kind of what it becomes all about. In the, like, third act, like you said, like once they realize like, oh, we can record these for scientific study. He's like, oh, hell yeah, let's go, fam. And he's like all about it. And he's super excited to be like on the forefront of the Brundlefly thing. And he's saving the parts that fall off so they can be like, he's got like, the Brundle Museum of Natural History or whatever he calls it. His like medicine cabinet with his teeth and his nose and his ears and all this gross shit.
I mean, I think you're right. It's this very human kind of impulse. Just like wants people to remember you in some way. But so after that, Veronica reveals to Seth that she's actually pregnant, and she knows it's Seth's baby. And that's when they have the dream sequence where she is like in the hospital and she's delivering the baby, and she starts screaming, and David Cronenberg's the guy who's like, you know, pulling the baby out, and it's like this larva sack that's like wriggling around, and it's really gross, and which is apparently what actually happens in The Fly 2. So
it turns out,
but for now it's a dream sequence. I can't believe, I mean, I haven't seen The Fly 2. It might be good, but like the idea that like she wouldn't go through with the abortion now seems insane after everything she went through in this movie. Right. Yeah.
It's like the idea we talked about The Descent on Mike and Mike Goes to the Movies. I don't know if we talked about The Descent 2, which I haven't seen. But apparently that starts with the survivor of The Descent 1 going back into the caves. It's like, that would never fucking happen. Why? Nobody would do that.
Yeah, exactly. But so that whole dream sequence is super gross and super crazy. And then after that, she decides, all right, she has to go get an abortion. And then you see Goldblum's teeth falling out. The machine won't recognize his voice. She goes back to see Goldblum one more time. She tries to tell him that she's pregnant, but she's going to get rid of it. But she can't bring herself to do it because Goldblum is just in such a weird shape now and a weird state of mind. And he has, I think, probably his best acting moment in the movie, the insect politics monologue. He's just like, there's no insect politicians. I'm going to be the very first insect politician. I was a bug that dreamt he was a man and loved it. But now the man is dead and the bug has awoken. It's so good.
Have you ever heard of insect politics? Neither have I. Insects don't have politics. They're very brutal. No compassion. No compromise. We can't trust the insect. I'd like to become the first insect politician. You see, I'd like to, I'm afraid,
I don't know what you're trying to say.
I'm saying, I'm an insect who dreamt he was a man and loved it. But now the dream is over. And the insect is awake.
No, Seth.
I'm saying, I'll hurt you this day.
And, you know, he sells it so well. And I mean, the makeup is doing a lot of the work, too. And it's incredible. It's so good.
Yeah. And he's like very twitchy and stuff, like more than Goldblum normally is. It's just so unsettling. But it is very, very good.
Yes.
But yeah, I had a oh shit moment coming up when we talk, I'm sure, when Gene Davis finally goes to the abortion, or goes to the doctor and like convinces him like in the middle of the night, like, I need this now. I need this abortion now.
Yep.
And she's like changing it in the exam room into a gown. And there's like this giant window, like frosted window. It's just like very ominous. A lot of negative space on this side of the screen. What's going on over there? And then Goldblum just fucking comes flying through Brundlefly comes flying through the window. And I was like sitting on the couch. I was like, oh shit. And like had to sit up yep. more. Once that happened, he's not prepared.
Yeah, it is such an ominously placed window. It's like a window designed for people to burst through it, like Kool-Aid Man style.
Yeah. Why?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but he does it. He bursts through and he kidnaps Gina Davis and brings her back to the warehouse that 90% of this movie takes place in. And so Stath is like, you know, realizes she's gone, and he like goes back to the warehouse. He arrives and he has like a shotgun, and he's like, and he sees the telepods and like, what's going on here? And then Goldblum attacks him from the ceiling. He like jumps down, which is crazy. And then he uses his mouth acid to dissolve Stathis's hand and then his ankle. And so his foot comes off. And then he's about to go for the head, but Veronica stops him. And so she's like, no, don't do it. And that kind of thing. And so Goldblum kind of reveals his master plan now that he knows that Veronica's pregnant, which is to fuse again with Veronica and the baby. And his head is like, we'll be the ultimate family. We'll just be together all the time.
Yeah. It's very good. Very good.
Yes, exactly. And so now there's three telepods, by the way. There used to be two. Now there's three. Or maybe there was always three. I feel like it starts off with just two, though, right?
There's two, but they tell you in the very beginning, Gina Davis asked him about this other one, and he's like, oh, this is the prototype.
Yes,
so there was always three, but they were only ever using two. Gotcha. Until now.
Yeah.
Dun, dun, dun.
See, it set it up right at the beginning for that third telepod. Yeah. It's perfect. And so now there's three telepods, one for him, one for Gina Davis, and one for them to meet in the third one, essentially, and like be a fused entity. And so she's like trying to get away. She rips off Goldblum's mouth. And that's when like just this is like the grossest part of the movie, I think. There's so much gross stuff up to this point. But when she rips off the mouth and there's like nothing underneath, and then his fly body starts like coming out of his human, like shedding his human skin and becoming the full version of Brundlefly. Mm-hmm. And you know, he's like lost the ability to speak and things like that. He's just a giant fly at this point. But it's not even like you can picture like a giant fly, and you can picture like, you know, you can see a fly and you can see a big version of that. But this is like a really gross version of what you picture the giant fly is going to be.
Yeah, it's very wet.
Yes, it's very wet.
And that's the worst part, is that it's wet.
Yes, it's goopy is what it is.
Very goopy.
But so yeah, he sheds his human exterior and he tosses her into the telepod, and he gets in the other one. The countdown starts. It's one of those things where it's like, you know, there's like 30 seconds on the clock, and Stathis is like, you know, barely conscious at this point. But he is able to shoot Veronica's pod at the last minute, like shoot the cables so that her thing disconnects from the telepod sequence. So then the fly starts trying to get out, but gets zapped before he gets the chance to. And then when he goes through, he gets fused with the telepod.
Yeah. not only is it like gross goopiness, but when he comes out and it's like biomechanical goopiness. Like it turns into like some H.R. Geiger shit where like he's got cables and like metal fused into his back and all this stuff. And he's just dragging himself across the floor.
Yeah. And he's just this mangled mess now. And so she's out of the pod and he's like just crawling towards Veronica, and she's like unable to believe what she's seeing. And she's like holding the shotgun, and he grabs the shotgun and moves it towards his head. And just silently beg, like he can't talk, he's a fly now. So he's just like silently begging Veronica to kill him. And like, she can't, like, she's like, I can't do it. I can't do it. And then finally she does. And then he dies. And then she falls down crying. And that's it. That's the movie. Roll credits. That's it. It gets out right there.
Man, that like is like the, you know, you said he the kind of like sympathy cycle that Brundle goes through, where he is just pure evil by the, you know, 30 seconds before this, when he like throws her in the telepod, and then he comes out and he's just like, please kill me. And he just feels right. So fucking terrible when he uses his like little gross claw to like grab the shotgun and put it to his head.
Yeah.
God damn.
It's intense. And then there's no epilogue. There's no moment where you're like, okay, let's find out what Gina Davis did after this. Nope. It's just, this is the end of the story. The credits roll, and that's all you get with The Fly, until you get The Fly 2, and then you find out that Gina Davis died.
Goddamn larva baby.
All right, so that is The Fly. It fucking rules. I mean, we're both big fans of this movie, right, Mike?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm very glad I finally got the chance to see it, as it was intended to see. So I'm glad, you know, I got this experience.
Nice. All right. Let's do some Letterboxd reviews for The Fly before we start wrapping this thing up. Here's a 4.5-star review from Hung Cat, which reads, "Is it too late for David Cronenberg to contact Disney for the Spider-Man directing gig?" "Disturbingly tragic and beautiful, this is the most messed up version of Romeo and Juliet ever presented on screen. The mutation of internal and external forces combine deep within the power of the flesh. Both collapse and destroy the borders of the soul to transmogrify the human physique into that of an insect. The horror works because it reminds us of something real, our fear of change when something inside us starting to break down and decay. A grotesque nightmare from which there is no real awakening as it hits you where it hurts the most, the core of humanity. Gooey blood splattered along with blood tissues, insectoid limbs begin to stick out, hair loss, fingernails fall off. The practical effects are absolutely sick. Cronenberg can turn the grossest of things around into the most humane portrait of a failed dream. Plus, Jeff Goldblum is breathtaking."
I'm sad that you found my alt Letterboxd account and used it as
it's fair. Here's a 5-star review from Paul Hubbard, which reads, "The Fly is basically perfect. So tragic and heartbreaking, it's both lovely and disgusting at the same time. Everything is working on all cylinders in this one. This is about everything in the 80s. It's about AIDS, though Cronenberg denies it, and it's not directly about AIDS, but it's also about loss and death, which indirectly points to the epidemic of the time. You get cocaine metaphors with the twitchy performance from Goldblum and the overuse of sugar. You get the abortion subplot. You get the distrust of science. Hell, you even get arm wrestling. The ending of this movie is one of the most gut-wrenching scenes ever in a horror movie. Just magnificent." And that's something I feel like we didn't get into that much, is that there is a lot of like stuff going on under the surface of The Fly as well. Just, I mean, this was 86, and it is, there's talk of like a pandemic. Like, this could potentially be contagious. Like, people are just becoming flies all over the place. And it's like, huh, weird to watch that in the coronavirus future that we live in right now. This is very strange.
Yeah, oh yeah, I definitely did notice that.
I will personally say I'm just glad the coronavirus is not the virus that's in this movie where Jeff Goldblum turns into a fly. I think that would be way worse.
Yeah, hard agree. I had a point and it is gone. That's fine.
That is unfortunate, but if you think of it in the next few minutes, Mike, let me know and I'll let you
make I'll chime it. In
Here's a 4.5-star review from Noah Thompson, which reads, "Get yourself someone who will care for you like Brundle cares for his baboon. The second baboon, not the first one. Definitely not the first one."
Oh, I got it. I remembered. Oh, are you done? Oh. Go ahead.
There's more to it, but you make your point, Mike.
I think it's interesting too that, I mean, the first one isn't Goldblum, but Goldblum is in Body Snatchers, which also has one of the most horrifying final moments in a movie, the pod person screech thing, and then also here where he gets his head blown off for his third on-screen death. Look at that.
Oh yeah, hey, didn't even we're supposed to be counting that. Yeah, I forgot about that. So that's what, Body Snatchers, Silverado, and now The Fly. That's what we're at right now. All right, keep that in mind. All right, let's get back to the review. I think at this point I can say that David Cronenberg is officially my new favorite horror director. Good job, you Canadian weirdo. The Fly is major stuff. I went back and forth on whether I like this more or less than Videodrome, and even though I think this is the better film objectively, I will say I like Videodrome more personally, if it's just a tad more. Plenty to be celebrated here. Jeff Goldblum's performance is incredible, both from his stunning physical acting to his surprising emotional range. I like Jeff as much as the next guy, but I would have never expected something like this from him. Yes, he's hot too. The Fly also has to be my new pick for the most intricately and effectively scary body horror I've seen from a film. For half of it, I just admired the craft and the refusal to hold back on blood and other bodily fluids. The other half, I was just slack-jawed and left wondering how the hell it was all done and how Fox was okay with most of it. Also, this is technically a Disney movie now. Putting this on Disney Plus would be the ultimate power move the company made this year.
Oh my God.
Can you imagine if you were scrolling through Disney Plus and you're like, oh, all right, there's Iron Man, The Greatest Showman, Hamilton, The Fly. How many kids would accidentally watch this? It'd be great.
I'm in.
All right. Finally, I got one more. It's a 5-star review from Jay, which reads, "If you say Jeff Goldblum is daddy, but hesitate when someone brings up The Fly, you ain't a real freak."
Yeah, I agree.
That's fair enough. All right. And I guess that brings us to the end of our review of The Fly. I think a good note to end things on. So yeah, we're both big fans of the movie. Obviously, it's an all-timer. My favorite David Cronenberg movie. And I think Jeff Goldblum's best performance too. So yeah, high marks from the mics right here on the podcast.
Absolutely.
All right. So that wraps things up this week. Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at MD Film Blog on Twitter and Letterboxd.
And you can find me online at M Smith Film Blog on Twitter, Mike Smith Film on Letterboxd, and Radio Mike Sandwich on Instagram. Thanks so much for listening to The Complete Works. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike DiCriscio. Don't forget to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or any other podcast app. And if you want to contact us, you can hit us up at JeffGoldblumCompleteWorks@gmail.com. You can find the Restaurant Podcast on Rapture Press alongside the Totally Original Geek News Podcast, a podcast about comic books and movie news and all that nerdy stuff. And you can follow this podcast on Twitter at GoldblumPod. Our theme song was created by Kyle Cullen, who you can reach for your own podcast themes at kylespodcastthemes@gmail.com. And our logo was designed by Jacob Honeycutt or at Jacob Honey on Twitter. Now join us next week in The Complete Works, where Goldblum reunites with Robert Altman for the first time in a while. It's 1987's Beyond Therapy, which I've looked into a little bit, not considered one of Altman's better movies. we'll see what happens. It could be fun. And you can keep listening for our bonus episodes of Mike and Mike Go to the Movies. Thanks so much for listening, guys. And remember to go for the Goldblum.
Nice. Hello, bloopers.
Get that out of there now. It won't happen again. I may have eaten two pulled pork sandwiches before we started this podcast, but it's not going to happen again.
Never again.
Now join us next week on The Complete Works, where Goldblum reunites with Robert
So close. You lied. This is the second one.
Man, it was supposed to make it through the whole episode.
Son of a bitch.
Oh, boy.